from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in this next hour of Forum, how much should appearance be part of discrimination laws? Should appearance be considered along with race, religion, gender, and disability? Should Hooters Restaurant be required to hire small-breasted women or women over 60 or homely men as table servers? Should publishers or romance novels be required to hire male models who are not bodybuilding specimens? Should tenure and promotion denials in university faculties mandate that everyone voting swear under oath how he or she did not include physical appearance in their decision? We'll spend the hour with Stanford Law Professor Deborah Rohde, and we'll talk with her about her new book, Beauty Bias, up ahead after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's second hour of the Forum program. Deborah Rohde is Ernest W. McFarland Professor of Law at Stanford and Director of the Stanford Center on the Legal Profession, as well as a columnist for the National Law Journal and a leading legal ethics scholar. She's been on Forum many times, and she's the author of some 20 books. Her most recent is all about looks and appearances in the law. We know that looks affect jobs and success in life. They even affect the way justice is administered. We did a whole hour recently on that subject. What about legislation to prosecute appearance, that is, discrimination in the workplace? Should such laws exist? Well, that, as well as the unhealthy and sometimes oppressive, as well as costly effects of our being a look of society, are what Professor Rohde takes up in her new book, The Beauty Bias, The Injustice of Appearance in Life and Law. And she joins us in studio, and welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you started off writing personally in this book. I recognize you're no clothes horse. You're out in the open about that. But also about shoes, interestingly enough. That is, a lot of the motivation for you came out of shoes and wearing. I'm thinking about Sex and the City episode called The Right to Shoes. you know, the sense of the pain they bring to women. I hadn't quite thought of it in conjunction with all that. But some would think, well, there's a lot more pain in the world than what we get from our feet, of course.
Well, yeah, and you know, it's not at the at top of the hierarchy in terms of issues for the women's rights movement. But what got me interested in part in writing this book was, on a kind of whimsical note, I wrote an op-ed piece for the New York Times about shoe design being the last haven for misogynists. This, after being trapped at a conference when I was chairing the ABA, the American Bar Association's Commission on Women in the Profession, and I was surrounded by women hobbled by their footwear, and we were trying to get to meetings, and there was a bomb strike in the tubes, and the Queen's mother was having a birthday, so the cab in traffic was impossible. These women literally could not walk in footwear ostensibly designed for the purpose, but in fact, you know, had heels that were calculated for anything. So I wrote this piece and noted that 80% of women have foot and back problems connected to inappropriate footwear. And I don't think anything I have ever written has gotten so much response. And the Times regrettably took out a line that was something like, of all the issues that are most important, this isn't at the top of the list. Nonetheless, I went on to say, it's one of the micro indignities that holds women back literally as well as figuratively. And I would say a good third of the mail was, why did you spend your precious moment in the Times on this issue? When, of course, I'd been penning earnest op-eds on all the other more important issues for years that the Times didn't find a need to publish. This was – whimsy was what they chose. But it drew my attention to the fact that we really don't pay attention to this as an issue of discrimination. And in fact, in terms of all the issues that the women's movement has targeted, this one we've made the least difference, I think. And in some ways, things are worse. More women are unhappy with their bodies than they were 25 years ago. To 90% of women, it's important. You know, half of young women would rather be hit by a truck than be fat, and a third would rather be mean or stupid. I mean, just plastic surgery is the fastest growing area of medical specialties. So we're kind of moving in the wrong direction.
What happened to the feminist revolution, which was supposed to devalue this whole thing, and Naomi Wolf and the beauty myth? Well, actually, when you mentioned that ABA commission meeting that was held in Chicago back then, it gave you some sense of the double standard, too. Because here you are, and you know, you're not certainly by any describe yourself as kind of frumpy or not caring that much about how you looked in terms of appearance. And here are these women who are telling you, you have to get skirts, you have to look better, we get a stylist for you, all this sort of thing. And you're thinking, what's going on here?
Well, you know, as chair of the Commission on Women in the Profession, it was somewhat of an irony that I was told I would need a hair person, a makeup person, and a personal shopper in order to have the appropriate presentation for the annual lunch. And, you know,
gender equality.
Yeah, and that they would pay for it. And of course, I said, no, you know, I will pay for it. If I can't do mascara at this point in my life, it should be my problem, not yours. But I was kind of, you know, bemused that I would not have one item in my entire wardrobe that would meet the look they were looking for, and wondered whether the president of the ABA would get similar grilling about his ties. And, you know,
didn't Sarah Palin's campaign spend more on her trousseau and her outfits and her makeup and stylist?
Well, you know, more on her makeup advisor than on her foreign policy advisor. And that speaks volumes about our misplaced cultural priorities, I think.
When we get to beauty and looks as a concern where discrimination is, it seems so subjective. I mean, you could say, for example, well, someone's beautiful, therefore they're a threat to some of the women who are interviewing them, that sort of thing. I mean, you get into all these areas, like I was saying in my introduction, you know, Hooters, should they be hiring men to wait on tables, or small-breasted women? They seem ridiculous on the face of it, but it's so much subjective.
Well, you know, that's the conventional wisdom, that beauty is in the eye of the beholder, and who knows what it is, and how could we enforce standards that prohibit discrimination on its basis. But in fact, there's a pretty wide degree of consensus across cultures and class, even race and ethnicity, about certain features. For men, it's height. For women, it's an hourglass figure. For both, it's clear complexion, nice hair, so forth. And, you know, sociobiologists argue that some of these used to be a proxy for fertility, and that's why we're hardwired to prefer facial symmetry, is another one. Things that make it seem as if the person doesn't have disease or a problem that would get in the way of reproduction. And in fact, the way that current cultural norms have evolved, they're counterproductive just from the fertility standpoint. Now we idolize overly thin women who are much more likely to have fertility problems than women of more normal weight. And 95% of the women that you see on television and in the media are not in the same weight range as most American women. They create this very unrealistic and unhealthy standard. And, of course, the eating disorders that accompany that level of weight are often extremely psychologically and physically damaging. So we have a kind of, I think, culturally distorted ideal that we ought to be challenging in a variety of ways, and law is only a small piece of the answer.
Well, let's talk about law, though, and the challenge for the moment. We just had Gavin Newsom here in the last segment, and I was thinking San Francisco has laws about appearance, so does Santa Cruz.
They do, and they are among six local jurisdictions that have those laws. One state, Michigan, has a statute banning height and weight discrimination. And contrary to the way that those laws are sometimes parodied by critics, they haven't released a barrage of loony litigation. In fact, Santa Cruz hasn't had a single complaint in 15 years. In San Francisco, the complaints that have come up, they have been infrequent, but they've been useful in focusing people's attention on some real injustices.
And wasn't that famous Jazzercise?
Right, yes. Jennifer.
That woman who was 240-some pounds, Jazzercise leader.
Right.
That was here in San Francisco.
Yes, and you know, she was denied a franchise by the company on the grounds that they were selling fit and toned, and she didn't have the image. In fact, she was fit and toned. She taught back-to-back aerobics classes. She had no trouble getting students, and in fact, there were a large number of women who responded to her complaint by saying, you know, we'd like to take an aerobics class from somebody who looks like us. And I think one of the things that was important about the case, and one of the ways that law can be useful, is it drew people's attention to the fact that it's fitness, not body size, that's really the best predictor of health. And you know, the kind of movement towards fitness at any size and emphasizing the need for exercise and more healthy nutritional and recreational styles is what's going to bring us on the path to greater both psychological and physical health. And we ought to be focusing more on that than on weight per se.
Talking with Stanford professor Deborah Rohde. Her book is called The Beauty Bias, The Injustice of Appearance in Life and Law. Of course, I can hear some libertarians saying, yeah, it's unjust, but that's the way it is. You know, you get your genes or whatever it is at birth and all that sort of thing. But there are some real poverty issues here, too. I mean, there are people who can't afford, for example, to look good in terms of the workplace and what the workplace demands. But there's also free will. I mean, there are people who are, say, bohemian or, you know, don't believe in necessarily making themselves spruced up or something along those lines. We've got a whole continuum, don't we?
Well, we do. And I think we should not object to employers having reasonable grooming codes. And, you know, if you're going to be selling suits, you ought to look like you're capable of picking one out. So it's reasonable for employers to impose certain measures. But I think we've given employers far too much latitude. And in some instances, especially where issues of racial, religious, identity, sexual orientation are implicated, why should we let employers dictate standards?
We're back to Rand Paul here.
Well, nothing to do with performance on the job. So, you know, banning earrings on an ophthalmologist or a worker in a pet supply store, requiring women to wear high heels, or in this recent suit against Hooters, there were three choices for uniforms: small, extra small, and extra, extra small. You know, those are unhealthy as well as unduly sexualizing the workplace. And I think we ought to require reasonable business justification before we tell, you know, a fast food cook that he can't have an earring. I mean, who cares? Why should an airline say you can't wear cornrows?
What about the Reno woman? That's a big case, isn't it, still?
Well, that was a case in which a bartender at Harrah's Casino sued the casino for its personal best standards that required her to wear makeup, have manicures, and her hair styled and fluffed every day. And she sued for sex discrimination because she argued that men weren't suffering the same kind of burdens. And in fact, the requirements for men were only that they have short hair and keep their nails neatly trimmed. And ironically, a panel of 11 federal appellate court judges said that she couldn't prevail because she hadn't proven that there was a disproportionate burden to these standards, as if you need an expert to say it takes time and money to apply makeup, tease and style your hair, etc. And, you know, as one dissenting justice said, it's not like makeup grows on trees. And I think, actually, is it just that federal judges are that out of touch with reality? I think more likely is that she was lesbian and that underpinning the decision was a real unwillingness to open that whole can of worms in a casino town in which sexualized workplace standards were everywhere. And you didn't want the – I think the courts just didn't want to go down that path. But I think they could have written a narrow holding that would have recognized that this is really a case in which she had great performance reviews. And the issue ought to be, you know, her merits, not her makeup.
Deborah Rohde is our guest. Her book is The Beauty Bias. So the three kind of major justifications for these kinds of laws are, first of all, equity and anti-discrimination, but also we get into the fact that they heighten disadvantages based on things like gender, age, race, and ethnicity, or for that matter, sex orientation. So we're talking about those as major criteria. And then there's another one, self-expression and cultural identity. Let's talk about that because that figures into this.
Yes. Well, those are cases where, for example, employers have prohibited Jews from wearing yarmulkes or women from wearing veils or men from wearing earrings or some kind of religious.
Often religiously signature. Connected as opposed to just somebody's looks, let's say. You
know? Exactly. And as I say, I think you ought to have to show a reasonable business justification for those restrictions, especially when they implicate religious and racial identity. And you know, the courts have occasionally allowed individuals to prevail on either constitutional grounds if religion is strongly implicated, but mainly not. And you can just hear a federal judge saying in some of these decisions, well, you know, why is wearing your hair and cornrow style so important to you? To which I think the question ought to be, well, why is it so important to American Airlines? I mean, if the job of flight attendant is to, passenger safety and food service, it shouldn't matter if they've got neatly kept cornrows. And So I think we need to look twice at some of these restrictions and even the ones that aren't necessarily freighted with cultural identity questions. You know, why shouldn't a janitor be able to wear a ponytail if he puts it under his cap? The notion that you're trying to maintain standards in the janitorial services industry for somebody who's working at night.
How about Disneyland throwing people out because they have ponytails or hair that's too long?
Or afros. Well, right. Well, you know, I'm going to give more latitude to the entertainment industry because part of what they're selling is image there. But I think we ought to think twice at least about the double standards that are there and ask some questions. Why, for example, on television will you see a Larry King or a Walter Cronkite, but never the female equivalent? And you know, women have been fired for, famously one meteorologist who was thought to be too old and dowdy, and Conan O'Brien said she's saggy with a touch of menopause. We ought to be trying to jog the public into a wider standard of acceptance, because women are very much subject to still a double standard.
Much of this is cultural, though. I mean, it almost boggles the mind how you have to change lookist attitudes that are so deeply and profoundly embedded. And the argument, let's say, from the anchor standpoint is, if I hire an older, saggy, not pretty on the eyes or good eye candy type of anchor, I'm going to go down in ratings, I'm going to lose revenue, and that's not what I'm about. That's bad for business.
Right. Well, and there I think you can make some reasonable business justifications, but I think we ought to be pushing the envelope a bit. I think that viewers, part of the reason why it's thought to be unacceptable is viewers are just, not used to seeing it. And if you had a wider range of those images on the air of very competent people, I think you might find that there was more tolerance and more interest in talent than you might expect. And the only way we can get from here to there is by challenging some of those. And I think once you move away from jobs where image is a key part of it, customer preference just shouldn't be a defense. You know, that was the argument that civil rights campaigns countered in the 1960s. White business people said, well, just people won't buy from blacks. And the courts, I think, appropriately said that's not a defense to racial discrimination charges, because that's just reinforcing the prejudices we're trying to combat.
Well, the other defense,
everybody has to do it. In fact, yes, people will buy from blacks. And indeed, that's what happened.
The other defense was, it's my business and I want to run my business the way I want to, and I don't want the government interfering. That's more the libertarian line, of course.
Right.
It gets to Rand Paul again. But what do you do about the fact that, can you really get an equal level playing field here? I think that's the big question. Can you really even approximate it?
Well, of course not. Looks matter. It hurts to be beautiful. It hurts not to be beautiful. I think people just don't realize quite how much, and the fact that we can certainly get at some of the most egregious forms of prejudice. And I think the primary value of law here is symbolic. It's an opportunity to raise consciousness about the most invidious and unfair forms of prejudice, ones based on cultural assumptions and stereotypes. Overweight people are lazy and undisciplined. And I think we can use in the cases of the most egregious instances the law to jog people into a deeper recognition of what the social price of our prejudices are. But it's only a small part of the answer. And when you've got such a strong financial industry set up to fuel our anxieties, laws on appearance discrimination are going to be a very small part of the solution.
What about, are you in favor of the sort of thing they were doing? I remember, I think it was in Detroit, they were interviewing people to join the symphony, the Detroit Symphony, and so they wouldn't have any racial bias or gender bias. They had them play
behind a screen.
Behind a screen, right. And there's some justification, I suppose, for that with looks, one could argue.
Well, yes, and I think that just it's part of a cottage industry of studies that reveals the extent of our unconscious prejudice. I mean, no one who was conducting these tryouts thought that they were discriminating on the basis of race or gender, and yet when people were forced behind a screen, you had radically different results along those lines. And blind resume studies do the same thing. People evaluate individuals differently when they see a photograph of an attractive person or not. You know, we can't entirely get rid of it, but I think we can force more of it out in the open. And in contexts in which employers are upfront about their prejudices, I don't think we should accept them as a justification if they're not reasonably related to the job performance.
There are a lot of women who feel that appearance is important to them. You know, this whole phenomenon now of Sex and the City 2 that's out there. I haven't seen it yet, but I hear it's reached new depths of vulgarity and materialism, at least so I read from the various reviews. But, you know, the emphasis is on, you know, women go to see this. They go to see this a lot for the clothes, the shoes. Carrie, the main character, big on shoes, buy shoes all the time.
Yeah.
And so how much, again, do we get into kind of regulating or trying to provide for what ought to be antipathy to that sort of thing when it's a matter of choice? And it's also, of course, herded in by the industries, as you point out. And then
you know, choice is always socially constructed and constrained, and what we see around us, fueled by advertising and the media and the visualization of images that are often unhealthy and certainly not good models for footwear choice, it's going to have a profound effect on the way that people perceive their own preferences. And, you know, I'm a realist at what we're up against in trying to change some of those standards. But I think you could try to nudge the industry slightly. For example, it shouldn't take the deaths of a couple models on the fashion runways to get the industry to be more serious about policing unsafe eating practices among models and not to hire those with severe eating disorders. And other countries have done that, and the sky hasn't fallen. And we ought to be doing it in this country, too. We ought to be shaming the women's magazines into including more healthy and inclusive images on the cover. And we ought to really, I think, crack down on some of the vicious commentary that comes to prominent women who don't meet the standards that we'd impose for models. I was just kind of appalled at the recent round with Elena Kagan, even having written a book on this subject. Still, just the outpouring of comments like she looks like she belongs in a kosher deli, or why do Janet Napolitano, Sonia Sotomayor, and Elena Kagan all look like linebackers from the New York Jets? You know, why do those women have to put up with comments like that? And why do the male talk show hosts feel entitled to make them? You know, appearance is not, after all, a job.
Some of these talk show hosts shouldn't talk because of the way they look, you know.
It's
always struck me as rather ironic that some who are the most judgmental about those things couldn't exactly pass a handsome test under most circumstances.
Well, a lot of the male justices aren't eye candy either, and you didn't hear that kind of comment in their confirmation
hearings.
That's
cruelty, and it's built into our subcultures, isn't it?
Well, yeah, but, you know, this is one of the last bastions of legally and socially acceptable bigotry. People feel much more entitled to comment on appearance than they now do on race or ethnicity or sexual orientation.
Let's find out what our listeners have to say. The book is The Beauty Bias, The Injustice of Appearance in Life and Law. Deborah Rohde, Stanford Law Professor, with us in studio. Your calls are welcome, and our toll-free number is available to you, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. Feel free to join us. It's 866-733-6786. Again, our toll-free number for your calls, 866-733-6786, or feel free to send us an email, forum@kqed.org, or join us by posting a comment or a question on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with Deborah Rohde, and she's a law professor at Stanford, and also is the director of the Center on the Legal Profession, and her book is called The Beauty Bias, The Injustice of Appearance in Life and Law. It's sort of like I told her before we went on the air, I'm not doing a review here, but kind of a couple books. It's a book that, well, sounds off about how appearance-obsessed we are and how much emphasis there is on appearance to our detriment as human beings, but also a book about where the law might figure in all this. And you are welcome to join us if you have some thoughts, questions, or comments. Again, our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. Our email address is forum@kqed.org. And you can always post a question or comment by going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and clicking on this segment. And we'll bring Louise in as our first caller. Hi, Louise.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a professor in hospitality management, and I think this industry is one of the worst in terms of prejudice against particularly women, women of color, women who may be overweight. I've sent interns out who are equally qualified, one African-American, one not, and one was told they did have a front desk position, another was told, oh, sorry, we only have housekeeping. You know, it just continues. And I guess the point with hotels is that they really want to maintain a level of customer service. But I guess my question is, you know, what can a student do at that point in terms of trying to establish themselves without prejudice?
Well, you know, not a lot. First of all, you know, in all but this handful of jurisdictions, it's legal to discriminate on the basis of appearance, and only if you can show that the employer is using appearance as a proxy for something else, e.g. race, will you be able to prevail. So if all of your interns who were offered only housekeeping positions were women of color, you might have a suit. But it's oftentimes very difficult to make that case, and for most people, it's career suicidal, and the financial and psychological costs of bringing suit are just going to be prohibitive.
EG, by the way, stands for example.
Sorry.
Spoken
yes.
Like a true lawyer.
Yeah, well, so I think what we need to do, laws would help in those cases. If there was an appearance discrimination prohibition in the jurisdiction, you could make a claim that they were exercising it in ways that weren't reasonably connected to work requirements. But I think you bump up against this customer preference argument, and we have to take that on. You know, during the 1960s, the airlines said they only wanted female flight attendants and ones who were attractive, and there were weight restrictions. And
remember those commercials, "Fly Me"?
Right, exactly. You know, courts ultimately said, you know, that's not what the job is, and the fact that you're male business. Passengers like women in hot pants is not a defense to this. And the airline industry recovered, even though it is a service industry, and there have been some successful claims based on sex discrimination against some of the standards that are really unrealistic, the weight restrictions. So I think that's the direction I'd like to see the law help us move. And short of that, I think you can just do what you can at a social level to shame some of these industries when it's so clear that they're being intolerant and reinforcing the disadvantages of already disadvantaged folks in the workforce.
Good luck to you, Louise. And speaking of disadvantaged, I suppose you can also make an argument on the basis of class. If somebody doesn't have healthy food or access to good gym equipment or makeup can be expensive, those kinds of things have to be factored in.
Well, yes. And I think part of the problem with our current obsession about appearance is it does really exact a special price for those who are living in nutritional and recreational deserts. And it exacerbates inequalities based on race and class. And we ought to worry about that. And we ought to, of course, do more to try to support more healthy lifestyles in those communities. But we also ought to try to remove some of the job discrimination that often accompanies being at the lower appearance end as well as socioeconomic end of the spectrum.
On we go to more of your calls, and we welcome Kim from Novato. Hi, Kim.
Hey, good morning. How are you doing? Love your show. Thank you. My comment is, obviously I'm going to have biases that I don't even know about, but I tend to appreciate people who are of all different races, ethnicities, looks, appearances, sizes, if they're presenting themselves well. In other words, if they're well-spoken, if they've got a good attitude, if they make good eye contact, if they're dressed in a way that doesn't make me go, oh, my God, what were you thinking? I from my personal point of view, I tend to start picking someone apart, sorry, if they're presenting themselves in a way that invites me to do that.
Well, and, you know, I as I said earlier, I don't have a problem with people imposing reasonable grooming standards, and especially where they're job relevant. And those are things people can change. So discriminating on the basis of those attributes is far less problematic than on the basis of, say, height or weight or physical attributes that people aren't in a position to change.
Yeah, my point is just those are the things I see more than, you know, if someone has those issues going in, they can, if they can change those small things, they might have a better go of it.
Yeah, well, I think that's very good career counseling.
And thank you for the call. What about, for example, I remember going into a place that it was a grill, you know, one of mm-hmm. these grill places, and the cook who was working at the grill had one of the worst cases of acne I've ever seen. And admittedly, it didn't exactly stimulate the palate.
Yeah. Well, you know, people said about the Americans Against the American Disability Act, you know, people don't want to look at ugly people. It's going to be a problem in service industries. And we as a culture, I think, made some decisions that those shouldn't be the basis for discrimination, except where there are obvious health issues or job related characteristics that are at play. But I think what's really appalling about some of the appearance discrimination cases that have been brought is they're brought by people who don't have any customer contact. So, for example, an overweight short order cook at McDonald's who's denied a job, even though he's going to be in the back room. So why then shouldn't be the focus be on how he cooks, not how he looks? So that seems to me just a pure case of cultural prejudice that we ought to be striving to rise above.
And we'll go to more of your calls. We welcome Hamira. Good morning.
Hello. I am a personal image consultant, and thank you for this discussion. I think it's very, very important for people to realize, especially as far as the laws are concerned. I actually work with most of my clients are professionals, educated, secure, smart people who are going through a change in their life, a divorce, or they need to change their career, they're launching a book, various things that basically they realize that if they change their image, outer image, how they present themselves, how they speak, they will be portraying a more positive or will be getting a reaction that they would like to get from whoever they're targeting. But I find a lot of people are very hesitant to ask for this help, even though their goal is not to be a supermodel or to wear 10-inch heels, which I actually do not advocate. So how do we make this an acceptable thing for people to feel that it's okay to pay attention to their image, that they're not being vain, especially if it's going to help them with a personal or professional goal?
Well, I think that you're right that we ought to recognize that image matters in the workplace and that people...
Not only in the workplace.
And well, certainly
well,
in...
Well, it definitely matters in your personal life.
In
right.
life.
Wow. Yes,
yeah.
I think that was Michael's appropriate point. But I guess what I'm interested in the book in doing is trying to challenge somewhat the societal standards. And, you know, we shouldn't put people in the position of having to be unduly preoccupied by appearance in jobs where it doesn't bear any demonstrable relationship to competence. And we shouldn't be punishing people for lacking attributes that, you know, we're all going to ultimately lack, youth being a prime example. And I think we shouldn't be penalizing women for seeming vain or frivolous when they care about these issues because they matter in the world. But we ought to be trying to make a world in which we have a more inclusive and tolerant set of social images. And that's where I'd like to see us move.
You ever look at the magazine racks?
Oh, I mean, it's research for this book. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, aside from like the Cosmo stuff and, you know, how to
thinner
make
thighs
him deliriously
in 30
happy
days.
And,
yeah.
And the bedroom type of stuff. I mean, it's just so much geared toward looks and cosmetics and, you know,
absolutely.
And that's who many of their advertisers are, of course.
Well, yeah, exactly. And, you know, they're That's what the market forces them to peddle. And ironically, you will see in the same issues an occasional reference to something like eating disorders, and surrounded by the models who have them. And, you know, the ironies there are. And you know, the other part I talk about some in the book is just the massive amounts of fraudulent claims that are made on the basis of, you know, products that dermatologists label cosmetic hoo-ha. You know, we spend billions of dollars on these anti-wrinkle creams and weight reduction, cellulite, seaweed that's going to, you know, eliminate fat on contact. And we ought to do a better job in policing the market on some of these products.
Deborah Rohde with us. Her new book is called The Beauty Bias. And Naomi Wolf, best known for The Beauty Myth, says this is a well-researched and thoughtful exploration of beauty ideals in legal, professional, and other hard-hitting real-life spheres, a serious contribution to the literature of the politics of appearance. We go to a couple of emails here. Here's a listener, Dan, who says, hi, you just stated that more and more women are unhappy about their bodies. Could that be connected to the fact that in the last 50 years, the waist size of the average American woman has increased 7 inches? I don't know where he gets that from.
Well, it's also that the average model size has gone down substantially, both, you know, in everything from Playboy to Miss America contests. So it's both that that our weight has been increasing and that our images of what's attractive have grown more out of touch with how we live and how we look.
Another listener, Trudy, writes, I'm so interested in your conversation. I'm 50, take pains toward my appearance to some degree, but have chosen to let my hair gray naturally. I wonder about discrimination on this issue. Here in Berkeley, I see plenty of similar-minded women, but see few in other areas, especially in Southern California and on the East Coast. There's a feeling that coloring your hair is simply a hygiene or grooming issue. Why is aging such a horrific phenomenon?
Yeah. Well, I talk a little bit about that and notice that in Congress, virtually all the female politicians over 50, none of them have gray hair. I mean, and, you know, we ought to worry about that being a job attribute for prominent women. And, I think people should have a choice in how they do it. And, you know, Hillary Clinton got all sorts of flack for both, you know, coloring her hair, but, you know, she cared too much, not enough. She was fat, bottom heavy was what was said on, you know, Larry King Live during her Senate campaign. Since when is that a job characteristic? So more power to you. But I don't think the answer is to, you know, I don't think there ought to be a feminist litmus test. You know, women must not color their hair. It's not a sellout. It ought to be a choice and one that should be less freighted.
You know, I was talking before, you were talking about TV and Hillary appearing on Larry King, and we were talking about TV anchors, for example. And, you know, I've known a number of TV anchors from my broadcast career, and many of them will tell you that what they hear most from as viewers is if they change their hair, or if their lipstick shade is different, or if they look different, everything. And it really is the whole culture. It's pervasive. It's endemic to everything.
Yeah, well.
Lookism, whatever you call it. Let me get another caller on here. And this is Steve joining us from, where are you in Pennsylvania, Steve?
I'm in Harrisburg. How you doing?
Yeah, hi. Join us, please.
Now, I have a question about appearances of choice, like the goth look. Now, if I was getting on a plane and my pilot looked like Tommy Lee, I wouldn't feel too safe.
Race is an interesting point, though. I mean, there is a discrimination of people with, you know, earrings and tattoos and nose rings and all those kinds of things.
Well, yeah, as I say, reasonable grooming standards, but I'm not sure what the question was. You'd feel unsafe or just affronted?
I was being sarcastic. I'm just saying, when you do those things to be antisocial, and when you're not accepted by society, isn't that what you were aiming for in the first place?
Well, we could probably, you know, I'm not a trained psychiatrist, so I think I'm going to avoid going too deeply into what the explanations are. But I guess I think we ought to have a slightly more tolerance for people who are expressing their identity. And
but where's the line? I mean, you know, during the 60s, thank you, Steve, for the call, there were a lot of people who just didn't like the looks of those of us who had our hair long, you know. It was a whole musical called Hair because of
right.
that, you know.
Yeah.
And the sense was that it wasn't even so much grooming. It was like a kind of prejudice against those who had long hair.
Well, that's because long hair was a proxy for ideology and a set of values.
And beards were, too.
Right.
And at one time, you know, one earring was and so forth. So get into that whole realm, don't you?
You do. And you know, that's I think that there are going to be fine lines here. But I think one thing to point out about the statutes, because people often worry that you were going to have a totalitarian regime if you enforce these, you know, courts have pretty much said that these grooming standards are perfectly permissible. And, you know, most employers, you know, can have restrictions on hair length, for example, without violating anybody's God-given rights. So, you know, I think we got to get a grip and realize that that these are oftentimes proxies for something else, and we got to look at what's going on underneath our preoccupation with the physical appearance.
Our guest again is Deborah Rohde, and her book is The Beauty Bias. And our next caller from Las Vegas is Alex. Hi.
Hello. Yeah. I also have a comment to make about the about discrimination. I feel like, to a certain degree, isn't that part of how humans have evolved to survive in our environment? I mean, to a certain degree, while it's unsavory to judge someone on the way that they look or their beliefs or especially their race or religion, it just seems like there is a correlation between some physical attributes and some behaviors. You made the comment earlier that someone who's overweight, you shouldn't, you know, automatically make the assumption that they're lazy, which of course you shouldn't. However, there are behavioral patterns that create these situations, and barring the fact that there's some medical issue or you know, something else going on, I mean, generally, these physical attributes are the result of their behavior.
Well, is it it's nature like or nurture? I mean,
sure, yeah, and I mean, to a certain degree, it's like we make these assumptions about people because, as a human being, that's how our minds work. I mean, it's where do you draw the line between, you know, being Sherlock Holmes and looking at someone's appearance and making a deduction about where they've been and how they are, or just straight up being racist? You know, I mean.
Yeah, well, let's. I think, of course, you have a point, but let's just take the issue of weight discrimination for a second. I think people sometimes underestimate how much of it is a matter of choice. You know, for most people, it's very difficult to lose weight, and some of it is behaviorally driven, but some of it is biologically based. And, you know, 95% of dieters regain their weight in 5 years. If it were just a matter of choice, you wouldn't see those figures, given the fact that we're investing $40 billion a year in weight reduction techniques. And I think what's invidious are the stereotypes that it's an accurate proxy for being undisciplined or unable to do the job. And an example I give in the book is a woman who was denied a job as a bus driver because the doctor doing the exam saw her waddling down the hall and just thought she wasn't going to be able to evacuate passengers in an emergency. But he didn't do any agility tests. In fact, the women didn't have any health problems. And that's the kind of prejudice I think we want to counteract to the extent we can.
There's some of our listeners, let me thank the caller who have emailed. Bree writes, in reference to the caller who mentioned her hospitality students being treated unequally in application for internships, now that we are starting to understand how frequently and easily we discriminate at the subconscious level, would it maybe make sense for the caller and others in a similar mentoring positions to contact these employers in a non-threatening way to just raise the possibility of unequal treatment? Or is the threat of a discrimination lawsuit so great that it erodes any chance of this kind of feedback being effective?
Well, I'd like to see exactly that kind of responsiveness. And many of the jurisdictions that have these ordinances have a conciliation process. So you don't walk into court. In fact, in Michigan, only one case ends up in court a year. Mainly what happens is you check out what people's understandings of the basis for the discrimination are. And in some cases, you just get employers to change their policy or establish that there were other reasons why the person wasn't preferred.
Here's Ryan, who says, to what extent is your guest advocating the legislation of morality? Although I'm able to agree that physical image should play a lesser role in determining success in our world, it seems as though what's being discussed constitutes taking a legal position against a biological prejudice. Furthermore, your guest differentiates between standards for the working world at large and the entertainment industry, which sells image. I would contend that nearly all industries sell image to a greater or lesser extent.
Well, many industries do, and I think that just as customer prejudice wasn't allowed as a defense for race or gender discrimination, it shouldn't be for appearance discrimination. And, you know, the notion that you can't legislate morality was what the Southern opponents of civil rights legislation famously claimed in the 1960s in arguing against the Civil Rights Act. And in point of fact, indeed, we can and do legislate on the basis of morality all the time. And we're not always successful, but we certainly move the needle. And that's happened with respect to race.
I get back to what I said earlier, though. I mean, there is a lot more subjectivity when it comes to looks. Race, it's out there. It's melanin, it's pigment, whatever, you know, on the
Absolutely.
Skin.
And you're only going to get at the most overt instances of it where people actually acknowledge that that's the basis or where you can have a very good pattern in practice. And that's not the vast majority of cases. So that's why I say law is only a tiny part of the solution.
Margaret writes, I'm listening to Forum while I'm coloring my hair to help maintain a more youthful image. It's been a difficult job hunt this past year, but I recently got a contract to write some corporate communication pieces for a Fortune 100 company. I was interviewed and subsequently hired by telephone, which was an advantage as I am 50-something woman. The interviewer focused on my experience with the same company and other features besides looks. I had also interviewed with a company dominated by younger workers, and the interviewer hardly looked at me and never contacted me further, and it was clear that he couldn't relate to me.
Yeah. Well, and it's those sorts of prejudices that I think we ought to be trying to counteract.
Keith writes, what about sales or commission-based jobs where the person simply may not get the sale because of personal prejudices about appearance, et cetera? Should the potential customer be held accountable in some way?
Well, I think that's going to be a tough road to hoe in this legal culture. I think I'd try to go after the easier targets and as I say, try to get rid of the most invidious forms of prejudice.
Here's Reba who writes, there was a study publicized on one of the credible TV news shows that tested babies' responses to photos of various people's faces,
right,
both traditionally ugly and beautiful. The babies responded more to the beautiful faces, although clearly there's a lot of cultural influence on how we value beauty. There's something undeniably innate about it as well.
Yeah, it starts very early, and that's goes back to the the fact that we're somewhat hardwired to use certain indices of attractiveness as proxies for health.
And Lisa writes, your guest mentioned that it is not okay to discriminate on the basis of weight because people cannot control it. I disagree with this statement. As someone who has struggled with weight my entire life, I can tell you from experience that we can control our own weight. In most cases in America, we can choose to eat enough but not too much to keep our bodies healthy. If a potential employee is overweight, it is not like being short or tall or having a big nose. An obese person may not be able to complete their work tasks, as carrying 50 to 100-plus pounds is exhausting and affects obese people's daily lives. Also, obesity is a sign of addiction. Would you hire someone who told you that they were a drug addict? Food addiction can be just as problematic.
Well, there's a wealth of research that's summarized in the book that we don't have time to get into here, suggesting that there's a biological basis for people's body sizes, and it's harder to change without severe, oftentimes, measures, and that what happens for many people is reliance on yo-yo dieting and unsafe and unhealthy eating practices in an effort to try to change their body size, which is to some extent at least partially genetically driven. And
I think it's individual to individual, though.
Well, I think we'd be better off as a society if we were more focused on healthy diets and and exercise and fitness. Those things are much more likely to correlate with physical and psychological health, and less obsessed just with body size. And I don't think that the extent to which you can control or not control it ought to be the decisive factor. I think it's whether it bears some relationship to the job performance and whether we as a society think stigmatizing on the basis of attributes that are at least partly beyond our control is the society we want to live in.
Adam, let's get you – excuse me, Mike, let's get you on here. Hi.
Good morning. This is kind of a tactical question, but I think that the employer side of this has to take a larger point if this is going to be successful in the long run, because, like you say, clearly the general public is going to be prejudiced in all kinds of areas. We had a Fortune 500 company that I worked for with thousands of employees, and at some point a few of us decided we were not going to wear jackets and ties. And it was not an environment where we were out and about all the time, but we had meetings with corporate executives, meetings with clients, And it just grew and grew and grew within the company to the point where nobody cared. You know, people could dress as, you know, sharply as they want. They could dress as casually as they want. But the word, I think Kim a while ago mentioned it, is how you present yourself. And as long as you're not doing something that's intentionally trying to outrage somebody, people just accepted you after a while. And I'm wondering what kind of strategies you have for working from the inside out as opposed to the outside in.
I think that's a great example. And I think getting employers to pay more attention to what employees' preferences are and to question some of their assumptions is one strategy. In Europe, for example, there are worker councils in which the employees actually have more of a say in what the grooming standards are. And they challenge things like, you know, why can't a bus driver wear shorts when it's hot, you know, if they're part of the uniform? One of the cases in which woman sued and didn't get a successful legal result but got the company policy changed involved makeup for airline personnel who were at the passenger service desk. And, you know, I think here the argument is if men's unadorned faces are acceptable, why shouldn't women's be, you know, if they're clean and hygienic and meet certain basic grooming standards? Why do we require only women to wear makeup? And the airline ultimately got it after the case got sympathetically aired in the press. So I think trying to work from within and challenging some of those standards and get employers to see that there are some important principles at stake here, even if the issue seems trivial, the principles aren't.
Well, you want to start a little bit of a revolution here, don't you?
Well,
I mean, legally as well as in terms of interpersonal and workplace type of behavior.
Well, you know, the feminists tried in the 60s. No bras, in fact, were burned, but they did drop some cosmetics into the trash.
Remember all the armpit hair and all that? Yeah,
Well, it's an unfinished
nostalgia.
Revolution.
It's ongoing.
Yes.
Thank you, Deborah Rohde. Good
Thank
to have you,
so
with
much.
Us. Again, her book, The Beauty Bias, and it's subtitled The Injustice of Appearance in Life and Law. We are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and an hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. And we want to thank you, our listeners, because we wouldn't be here without you. We also want to thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and Forum's executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation, and the Bernard Osher Foundation, supporting higher education and the arts.